blue sign hurtles through space toward a green planet. Turner. Now, a logo of a thick-maned lion framed by a ring of film, Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. Titles appear over an illustration printed on fabric. Four women stand in a wintry landscape. Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer presents Little Women, a Mervyn LeRoy production, copyright 1949, starring June Allison as Jo, Peter Lawford as Laurie, Margaret O'Brien as Beth, Elizabeth Taylor as Amy, Janet Leigh as Meg, Rossano Brazzi as Professor Bear, Mary Astor as Marmee. This film has been described by Descriptive Video Service, a division of the Media Access Group at WGBH, with funding by the U.S. Department of Education. Described by Dutch Priest. Read by Pat Lentz. For more about DVS, call 1-800-333-1203 or visit our website at dvs.wgbh.org. More titles. Lucille Watson as Aunt March, Sir C. Aubrey Smith as Mr. Lawrence, Elizabeth Patterson as Hannah, Leon Ames as Mr. March, Harry Davenport as Dr. Barnes, Richard Stapley as John Brooke, Connie Gilchrist as Mrs. Kirk, Ellen Corby as Sophie. Screenplay by Andrew Salt, Sarah Y. Mason, and Victor Hermann. From the novel by Louisa May Alcott. Musical score by Adolf Deutsch. Color by Technicolor. Directors of photography, Robert Plank, ASC, Charles Schoenbaum, ASC. Art directors, Cedric Gibbons and Paul Gross. Set decorations, Edwin B. Willis. Costumes designed by Walter Plunkett. Produced and directed by Mervyn LeRoy. Now, another illustration shows a snow-covered road that runs alongside two houses. The illustration becomes real. The first house, a brown two-story, has a modest wood fence. The brick mansion next door stands behind a wrought iron fence with short brick columns. Smoke drifts from the house's chimneys as a man trudges up the road leading a horse. The horse drags a bound fir tree behind it. Now, an adolescent girl runs down the road, her full dress and coat billowing with each step. Now, two young women and a girl gaze somberly through a frosted window. They watch Jo, who vaults the fence and falls face first in the snow. The girls inside laugh. As Jo looks up, she spots their little faces. Jo eyes them, purses her snowy lips, and picks herself up. Slinging a pair of ice skates over her shoulder, she stomps out through the front gate, takes a few steps up the road, and faces the fence again. This time, she vaults over and lands solidly on her feet. She grabs up some snow, makes a snowball, and hurls it at the window. The three girls gape. Jo saunters indoors and hangs up her winter layers. One of the girls trims a scrawny Christmas tree.
Did you hurt yourself, Jo?
No, I never hurt myself.
Jo glances in a mirror.
Where have you been, Jo?
Skating. And it was splendid, my Beth.
Look, we've just finished trimming the tree.
Jo joins her sisters.
Oh, Christmas won't be Christmas without any presents.
Meg sews.
Oh, it's dreadful to be poor.
I especially feel it because I remember when we used to be rich.
Amy looks up from a sketch pad.
I certainly do not think it's fair for some girls to have plenty of lovely things. And other, prettier girls to have nothing at all.
We are better off than a lot of people. Orphans, for instance. We have Father and Marmee and each other.
We haven't got Father and probably won't have him for a long time.
Jo lies by the fire.
But the men in the army are having such a terrible winter. So I think it's right when Marmee said we shouldn't buy each other presents. We have to make sacrifices.
Meg.
I'm glad to make them. Only I'm tired of making these dresses over year after year.
Huh. At least you're the first to wear them, as you are the oldest.
Well, I don't think any of you suffer as I do. You don't have to go to school with impertinent girls who label your father just because he's poor.
If you mean libel, then say so and stop talking about labels as if Papa was a pickle bottom.
I know what I mean, and you needn't be satirical about it. It's proper to use good words and improve one's vocabulary.
Vocabulary?
Christopher Columbus, aren't we elegant?
Don't use slang words, Joe.
And stop whistling. So boyish.
That's why I do it.
She leans defiantly toward Amy.
Oh, how I detest rude, unladylike girls.
And I hate affected nimini-pimini chits.
Birds in their little nests agree.
Meg regards her sisters.
Amy, you're too prim. If you don't take care, you're going to grow up and be an affected little goose. And as for you, Joe, now that you turn up your hair, you should realize you're a young lady.
I'm not.
Joe lets her hair down.
The turning up my hair makes me want a word and two tails till I'm 90. I won't grow up and be Miss March. I won't wear long gowns and look like a China Aster. Oh, I'll never get over my disappointment at not being a boy. Look at me. Dying to go and fight by father's side, and here I am, sitting and knitting, like a pokey old woman.
Knitting? Bless me.
Beth sits beside Joe.
Poor Joe.
Oh, I don't want any pity. Because someday I intend to be a famous writer and make my fortune selling stories. Then I shall live and behave as I please. And you'll all ride around in fine carriages.
She holds Beth's chin.
And you, my Beth, you will have a new piano. And Meg, you will have 10 dozen dresses and satin slippers. And red-headed boys to dance with.
I should like that.
So there's no use fretting now. Come on, let's rehearse the play. Beth, you play something gruesome. Amy, I wrote a new scene for you. It's wonderful.
Oh, no.
Well, it's perfectly simple. All you have to do is shout, Rodrigo, Rodrigo, save me. And faint.
Rodrigo, Rodrigo, save me. And faint. Oh, I can do that. I planned my costume, too. It's absolutely plain, with all the colors of the rainbow in it.
Impossible.
Amy frowns.
Why?
She stands.
I am a princess, am I not?
She looks in a mirror.
Yes, you are a princess, but you don't know it. You think you're a servant girl working for Beth, Hagar, the witch.
A princess always knows she's a princess.
Well, you don't. Look, Beth has just left the stage with her kettle full of simmering toads. You are locked in the tower. Suddenly and unexpectedly, Hugo the villain enters. You cry out in horror, Rodrigo, Rodrigo, save me, and faint. Then Rodrigo, Meg, enters.
Meg Rodrigo? I thought Meg was Don Pedro, my father.
She is, but you don't know it. Amy, I've told you 1,000 times till the end of Act 5, you haven't the slightest idea who you are.
Amy plops into a chair.
Well, does Meg know?
Of course I do.
Well, then I want to know, too. Why should I always be so ignorant?
Simply because if you know who you are, the play is over.
Well, it's too long anyway.
Amy, please, after all, it's my play.
And the best we've had yet.
Joe's a regular Shakespeare.
Oh, it's nothing, really.
Joe disappears around a corner.
Now, ready?
Beth scurries to the piano.
You ready?
Staring intently at the sheet music, Beth plays. As Amy fingers her golden curls, Joe enters haughtily and strokes a non-existent mustache.
I'm Hugo. I come in, and with wicked intentions, I say, ha! And I come closer. Ha!
A gray-haired woman brings a tray.
Come and get your tea, girl.
They gather round.
Don't we ever have coffee anymore?
Coffee is scarce and dear. Ships are needed in the war. They've no time to go to Brazil and bring back coffee for Miss Amy March.
The old woman spots a man next door.
And some folks seem to have nothing better to do than to pry into other folks' business.
Who is it, Hannah?
That Lawrence boy. What Lawrence boy? Mr. Lawrence's grandson.
Ha! I didn't know the old fusspot had a grandson.
Well, he just came last week. But from what I can find out, he must be a fine one.
Why? What's he done?
Well, first he ran away from school.
Huh? That's the bravest thing I've ever heard of.
Amy stares wide-eyed.
They couldn't trace him anywhere. When they did find him, he was in an army hospital, wounded. He joined up under another name and lied about his age.
How perfectly splendid. I should like to do the same.
Fine soldier you'd make.
With arms folded, Joe watches Hannah close the shutters. As the sisters have their tea, Hannah leaves the room. Joe opens the shutters.
Joe.
It's our private property, and I can look out of it as much as I like.
Well, you're every bit as bad as he is.
A young man appears in a window.
There he is.
Meg hurries over, followed by her younger sisters.
Amy, Beth, stand back a little.
Joe gazes out wistfully. The finely dressed young man stares back.
Well, I'm glad he's a boy. Certainly would like to know a boy for a change and have a little fun.
Don't say such things.
Meg scowls.
I wonder how I could get to know him.
Joe keeps staring.
I wish our cat would get lost and he'd bring it back. Then we'd get to talking. I don't think that's very romantic.
Joe looks at Meg.
Who said anything about romance?
She turns back to the window.
You!
She waves her arms.
Hello!
Joe, you're disgracing us.
Hello!
The young man waves. Joe's smile goes slack and her eyes widen.
That dreadful boy, he waved back.
Meg moves to her side and closes the shutters. Next door, the young man pulls his full-length window shut. Now, Beth plays the piano wearing an orange witch's hat and fake gray hair. Nearby, Meg watches as Amy stands draped in a sheer lavender shawl. Wearing a crown of gold stars, the blonde girl gazes upward and clasps her hands. Joe enters. She wears a wide-brimmed hat and strokes a pine sprig secured under her nose.
I'm Hugo.
Ha-ha. Ha-ha.
Amy's pose stays the same.
Amy.
Amy looks.
You're supposed to draw back in horror.
Amy complies.
Now cover your eyes with your hands.
Amy flutters her fingers.
Rodrigo! Rodrigo! Save me!
She looks in a mirror.
Save me!
As Amy fixes a crooked star on her crown, Joe frowns.
Amy. Amy, watch me do it.
Amy throws her hands out.
Rodrigo! Rodrigo, save me!
Beth and Meg curiously watch Joe as she spins around and collapses on the floor.
And faint.
As Beth and Meg applaud, Joe bows and flourishes her hat.
Oh, nothing really. Now, here I come again, Amy, with wicked intentions.
She runs out, draws the parlor drape shut, then opens them.
I'm Hugo!
Ha-ha!
Amy feigns terror.
Ha-ha! Here I come with wicked intentions.
Drops a pillow in one corner of a couch and faints. As Joe wrinkles her nose at Amy's performance, Beth and Meg grin.
Glad to find you so merry, my girl.
Marmy!
Marmy, look, she's from the
home. How did everything go today?
Look, Marmy, we've almost finished cutting the tree.
Have you had your supper,
yes,
Marmy?
Yes, dear. Bethy, dear, give me another kiss, baby. Joe, you look tired to death.
Oh, I'm all right.
How's your cold, Meg?
Oh, it's practically gone. And, Marmy, I went to see Mrs. King about the position. She's going to take me, and I'm to start Monday. $4 a week.
My Meg, I'm proud of you.
They have a beautiful house, and the children are sweet. Marmy, I don't mind working at all.
Beth offers slippers.
Put these on, Marmy. They're nice and warm.
Thank you, Bethy, dear.
I'll rub them for you.
Amy rubs Marmy's hands.
Oh, dear, the army's so short of blankets, we started cutting up carpets today.
I wouldn't mind sleeping under a carpet if they'd only let me do something. Oh, I'd make a wonderful nurse. Or a drummer.
Joe, dear, get my muff. I have a surprise for you.
Surprise for Joe?
For all of you.
She pulls out an envelope.
A letter!
A letter from Father!
Marmy unfolds the pages.
He sent you a little Christmas message.
They turn.
What's that? Sounds like dear old Aunt March.
Beth goes to the window and sees a driver sitting in a large red sleigh.
Yes, it's her sleigh.
Amy lets in a plump, matronly woman.
Good evening, Aunt March.
Not at all, miss, not at all. It's freezing cold, and you haven't shoveled a path to the door. I might have slipped.
Merry Christmas, Aunt March.
So nice of you to come.
Yes, it was nice of me to come.
Come in by the fire.
Thank you, no. I have a fire at home where I should be at this minute. I only came to bring you these.
She hands each of the girls an envelope.
Thank you, Aunt March.
Joe.
Thank you, Aunt March.
Beth.
Thank you, Aunt March.
Amy. Where's Amy?
Amy's behind her.
Here I am, Aunt March.
Well, what are you doing back there? I don't like this sneaking about. Come out into the open, I always say.
Thank you, Aunt March.
Well, when I was a girl, I used to visit my aunts to wish them a Merry Christmas. They didn't visit me. See that you spend it wisely.
We plan to visit you tomorrow, Auntie.
You never know if there will be a tomorrow. Have you heard from that foolish father of yours, waltzing away to war and leaving others to take care of his family? It isn't preachers that are going to win this war, it's fighters.
We're very proud of Father, and you should be too. And there's nobody looking out for us,
Joe.
Hoity-toity.
Some tea, Auntie.
No. If your father had listened to me, you'd be better off today. I begged him not to invest his money with that swindler. One look at him, and I knew that he would take the pennies off a dead man's eyes.
That was years ago. It has nothing to do with now. And it was our money that got lost anyway.
Don't be impertinent, miss. It's a waste of time to talk to you. Nobody listens to me anyhow. Merry Christmas, Aunt March.
Joe's eyes shift thoughtfully and she runs out after Aunt March.
Aunt March, you still want me to work for you, don't you?
Find time to ask me.
I'd like to be your companion.
A companion should be companionable.
I will be, I promise. I'm willing to bury the hatchet.
Aunt March gets in the
sleigh. Very well, then. Come over after the holidays. 9 o'clock sharp.
She winks.
Bring an apron.
Joe smiles.
Thank you, Auntie.
Merry Christmas, Aunt March.
Merry Christmas.
The driver jiggles the reins.
Oh!
The sleigh goes over a bump. As Jo strides back into the house, her sisters surround her, showing their open envelopes.
Look, Jo, a dollar!
She gave it to Dollar!
How splendid! Now I can buy the Black Avenger.
Oh, I've been longing for a bonnet with a feather.
A nice box of Faber's drawing pencils for me.
And what will you do with your dollar, Bethy?
I'll buy some new music.
There we go now, Marmy.
Marmy nods.
All right.
Oh, we're going to have presents after all. Oh,
Marmy. Merry Christmas time is here. Happiest time in all the year. Ding dong.
Left alone in the parlor, Marmy gathers her cloak and gloves, then gazes toward the hall. Her daughters, bundled in their white layers, head out the door. Through the window, Marmy watches them file past the fence. As she picks up her hat from a plush velvet chair, she sees her husband's letter on the cushion. Now, in a general store, three elderly men sit bundled up smoking pipes. Two play checkers as the other watches. The girls appear outside and peer in the store window. One of the elderly men points to them with his corncob pipe. The other two take a look.
Think maybe I ought to close up before somebody comes in and wants to buy something.
As he rises, the girls hurry through the door.
Merry Christmas, Mr. Gray.
Merry Christmas, Mr. Gray.
Oh, your store is just beautiful.
Howdy.
We each have a dollar to spend.
So I would like to look at your Faber's drawing pencil.
And I'd like the Black Avenger by Lady Abington.
Is that the book you was reading t'other day?
Yes, that's the one.
Then you better get another. You almost finished that one, sitting right there on that ladder.
Meg chimes in.
I'm looking for a bonnet, Mr. Grace. Velvet with a dashing feather and a moss rose or two and a wisp of a veiling and an ornament about here for a dollar.
You do you? Over on that there shelf.
Thank you, Mr. Grace.
He looks at Beth.
Now, what'll you have?
Amy glances at the little girl.
What's the matter? Cat got your tongue?
No, sir. She's overcome with timidity. She would like some music. All she can get for a dollar.
Mr. Grace points.
Over there on that table.
Beth curtsies.
I would like a dollar's worth of Faber's drawing pencils. And wrap them, please. And would you tie them with a red ribbon?
A red ribbon? All right.
Oh, thank you.
Red ribbon.
The merchant steps behind the counter. Meanwhile, Meg tries on a pink hat and ties the ribbon beneath her chin. Jo brings down a book from the stepladder.
Got your Black Avenger, Miss Josephine?
No, I finished it. Skimmed through it while I was waiting.
Well, I hope you liked it.
Oh, but I didn't. The ending was weak.
Mr. Grace looks at her latest choice.
The Duke's Bride.
He hands the book back.
If you don't like it when you're through with it, bring it back.
Thank you, I will.
I've decided on this one.
Oh, you have you?
There are five of them, Mr. Gray.
Fine.
Thank you, Mr. Gray.
Merry Christmas.
They start to leave.
Oh, just a minute.
From a shelf near the door, Mr. Grace takes down a jar of peppermint sticks and gives one to each girl.
Thank you, Mr. Grace.
Thank you, Mr. Grace.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Grace.
Thank you.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Thank you.
Grace. Night. Merry Christmas.
Later, in the night air, the sisters stroll home side by side.
It came upon a midnight clear, that glorious song of old, from angels bending near the earth to touch their hearts of gold. Peace on the earth, goodwill to men. From heaven's all gracious King, the world in solemn stillness lay to hear the angels sing.
Later, their gifts lie arranged under the tree. The girls sit around Marmy as she reads the letter.
To my loving wife and children, give my girls my love and a kiss. Tell them I think of them by day, pray for them by night, and find my best comfort in their affection at all times. I know they will remember all I said, that they will be loving children to you, will work diligently so that these hard times need not be wasted, fight their bosom enemies bravely,
and conquer themselves so beautifully that when I come back to them, I may be fonder and prouder than ever of my little women.
Beth wipes her eyes. Hannah hesitantly comes into the parlor.
Yes, Hannah?
A message from poor Mrs. Hummel, ma'am. She wants to know, can you come?
Marmee nods.
Right away. You get my boots, Amy, please. My wraps, Joe?
Joe fetches her cape, scarf, and muff and puts the cape around her shoulders. All the girls stand, their hands folded in front of them. Marmee takes her muff from Joe.
Good night, my children.
Good night, Marmee.
Marmee hesitates on her way out.
Don't wait up for me. I might be late.
Night.
Night.
As their mother pulls up her hood and leaves, Beth fingers the holes in Marmee's slippers.
Marmee really ought to have a new pair of slippers.
Well, I'm the man in the family while Papa's away, so I'll supply the slippers.
Beth thought of them first.
Then I'll buy her army shoes. Best to be had.
And I shall get her a nice pair of gloves. Pink ones.
At the tree, Meg picks up her pink bonnet and walks off. Amy steps forward.
A little bottle of cologne for me. She likes it. And it won't cost much. Then maybe I can keep some of my pencils.
Now, Beth sets down the slippers and reaches for her sheet music. Joe fetches her book.
But Joe, won't the store be closed?
We'll storm the Citadel.
Later, different gifts are arranged under the tree. Blue slippers, a bottle of cologne, pink gloves, and black leather shoes. Each gift has a card. In nightgowns, Meg, Joe, and Beth light the tree's candles. Amy comes downstairs.
Has anybody seen my clothespin?
No one's taken your clothespin, Amy. You ask that every night.
You probably hid it under your own bed.
It's not there. I looked.
Meg blows out a lamp. Joe runs to the window.
It's Marmee. Scuttle, girls.
As they disappear upstairs, Marmee opens the front door and steps into the entryway. The glow from the tree's candle spills into the hall and washes across Marmee's face. The woman looks toward the lit tree, then up the stairs. Entering the parlor, she undoes her cape and sets to blowing out the candles. Upon blowing out a third, she sees the gifts, each with its handmade card. One reads, "To Marmee from Beth," and shows a dove in flight. Meg's has a yellow daisy on it. Amy's reads, "Merry Christmas," and shows a basket of flowers. Joe's depicts a winter landscape with half a sun on the horizon. Marmee shakes her head slightly and stifles tears. Smiling warmly, she rises and blows out the last of the candles. The parlor goes dim. At the top of the stairs, her daughters scramble into their rooms. Marmee hangs up her cape and scarf and peers upstairs before going up. At the top of the stairs, she eyes the closed doors of the bedrooms. A table lamp glows softly. With a smile, Marmee picks it up, slowly pushes one door open, and looks in. Under the lamp's glow, Meg lies in her bed with her eyes closed. Marmee withdraws, carefully pulling the door shut, and walks to a second bedroom. Entering, she finds Joe in bed. The young woman's eyelashes flutter and a smile plays on her face. Marmee gently closes the door. Moving to a third door, Marmee lifts the lamp and looks toward the bed, where Beth lies hugging a rag doll. The doll's hair is as dark as her own. Beside her, Amy, in her pink nightgown, lies on her back with a clothespin clipped to her nose. The clothespin points straight up. Marmee gently pulls the door shut behind her. Morning, the girls come down to the dining room.
Christopher Columbus!
Kidney pie and
popovers!
And coffee.
And everything.
Oh, I don't know when I've had a popover.
Merry Christmas.
Oh, Merry Christmas, Hannah. The table looks beautiful, Hannah.
Hannah, you do beat the Dutch.
See what all the fuss is about. I remember when I served a breakfast like this every day.
We must have been enormously rich.
Tell me, Hannah, how was I dressed when we had all that money?
In diapers.
Amy grabs a popover.
Amy, wait for Marley.
Mom says no. You're to have your breakfast and go to church. She'll meet you there.
Why, where is she?
The girls sit.
At the Hummels.
Hannah pours coffee.
Mrs. Hummel had her baby early this morning.
Another baby? Popovers.
Amy bites into one.
One baby after another. 6 children half frozen, huddled in one bed. No fire in the stove. So your mom took her breakfast to them. Not that there was enough to go around.
Amy takes another bite.
I believe in charity, but after all, when you cook a decent meal once in a blue moon, you like to see it enjoyed.
Hannah fills Amy's cup.
Besides, we don't have any to spare.
You're absolutely right, Hannah.
As Amy lifts another forkful, Beth sits motionless.
What's the matter, Beth?
I'm not hungry.
Oh, Beth. People are starving everywhere, every day. If you're going to let that worry you, well, you'll never eat at all.
I try not to think about it.
Meg shoots a scolding look at Amy.
Those people are far away, and we don't know them.
to the Hummels.
Joe and Beth look at Amy.
Oh, no. You couldn't think of a thing like that.
I could.
So could I.
Well, either all of us do it or none of us. Fine, we'll vote.
That's fair.
All right. But I insist on secret voting.
Oh, Amy.
Amy snatches up another popover. Later, outside, Hannah and the girls set off with a basket, some firewood, two milk cans, and a couple of covered dishes. As they file through the fence's turnstile, the young man from the window and a taller man stroll toward them. Amy, the last in line, lifts the cloth that covers the popovers and swipes one. Joe sees her.
I'll carry the popovers. You take the milk.
Not at all. I'll carry them.
Joe yanks them from Amy. One falls in the snow.
You dropped this, madam.
Thank you, sir.
Come on, Josephine.
Amy grabs the milk and brushes past.
You live next door, don't you?
Yes, I do. My name's Theodore Lawrence, and this is John Brooke, my tutor.
Joe hands Theodore the popovers and shakes John's hand.
How do you do?
I'm Joe March, and I'd like you to meet my sisters. It's Meg, and the other two up the road are Beth and Amy.
How do you do?
Meg nods at John. Joe smiles at Theodore.
We know all about you, you know. About how you ran away to join the army. Oh, and I'd have done the same in your place. And how you were both in the same regiment, which is splendid.
Josephine, come on, please.
Joe shakes the men's hands.
Well, bye.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye, Miss Walsh.
Meg eyes Joe.
What will they think? Stopping to talk to me, hadn't met them properly.
I don't care. Anyway, you weren't very friendly. You wouldn't even say howdy do.
I didn't like the way that man stared at me.
What man? Oh, Mr. Brooke? I didn't notice.
Well, I did.
Meg glances over her shoulder.
He's still looking.
Who?
Mr. Brooke.
Don't look back.
Who, me?
Now, in the Hummels' one-room house, Hannah puts wood on a stove. As Joe washes dishes, Meg spoons stew into bowls. Marmy stands over Mrs. Hummel's bed, bundling the woman up. Amy feeds pieces of popovers to five children in a single bed.
One for you. One for you. And one for me.
Not in the phone.
One for you.
One for you.
One for you. And one for me.
Here's one for you.
Beth sits in a rocker with the new baby.
And that tastes good.
One for you.
Later, back at home, Joe vigorously shovels snow. Nearby, a snowman wearing a top hat and scarf grips a broom. Joe takes a rest and leans on the shovel. The elbow of her sweater is frayed. She puffs out an exhausted breath and glances up at the Lawrence house. Grinning mischievously, she makes a snowball and runs to the edge of the property. Joe hurls the snowball and watches it arc toward the upstairs window. Theodore opens the window and smiles. He wears a compress around his throat.
Hustle yourself and come on out and help me.
God, I have the quinsy.
Oh, what a shame.
Oh, it isn't contagious. I can have visitors. I don't know anyone, though.
Well, you know me.
Would you care to come over and keep me company?
Joe turns and runs.
Marty! Marty!
Now, a butler marches across the parquet floor of a lavish foyer. Stepping past a grand curving staircase, he opens the door.
Miss March, calling on Mr. Lawrence, the young one.
Won't you come in, Miss March?
Thank you, I will.
As she takes in the decor, her host trots down the stairs.
Hello, Miss March.
Hello.
Let me take your coat.
Thank you.
As Theodore hangs it up, Joe holds out a small bundle.
Here's some blancmange. It's soft and will slide down easily.
Oh, thank you.
Well, I've come to entertain you. I'll read aloud and you can listen. I do love to read aloud.
Well, I'd rather just talk if you don't mind.
Oh, no, I love to talk, too.
Very well.
As he steps through an archway, Joe freezes. She admires the furniture, rugs, and artwork of an immense parlor.
Christopher Columbus! What richness! Why, this is a palace! Oh, it's marvelous! So roomy and so full of things! Oh, and look at the flowers! They're lovely! Absolutely lovely! I call this splendor, I really do! Theodore Lawrence, you ought to be the happiest creature alive!
She beams as he pours tea.
Oh, it just looks like a room to me. And it certainly doesn't make me happy. Let's have some tea. How many lumps?
One, please.
He pinches one with tongs.
Three.
As he adds two more lumps to her tea, she glides over from behind a golden yellow fainting couch.
Well, Mr. Lawrence, now do tell me all about yourself. Of course, I know all about your school and the army. In fact, everything. But before that, what?
Well, I used to live in Europe with my parents.
Europe? I'm going to Europe, you know.
Really, when?
Oh, I don't know exactly. You see, my Aunt March, I just started to work for her as companion. Oh, and what a nervous, fidgety soul she is, too. Well, anyway, my Aunt March has rheumatism, and the doctor thought baths. Oh, not that she hasn't got a bath. She has a very nice one.
Joe chews a biscuit.
Do you get any baths while you were there, Mr. Lawrence? I mean, for your rheumatism.
I haven't got rheumatism.
Oh, well, neither have I. But you see, I figured baths wouldn't do me any harm. That is to say, while I was there. Because I've always wanted to go to Europe. Not for the baths, of course, not at all. But for my writing. It's so good for writers. You see, Aunt March... Oh, but you don't know Aunt March. What were you going to say, Mr. Lawrence?
I wasn't going to say anything. But I'm not Mr. Lawrence. I'm Laurie.
Well, Laurie. Well, how are you getting along with your grandfather, Laurie?
Oh, fine, fine. Once I get used to him. You know, he's... Well, he's all right.
Yes, I know.
Isn't he a holy terror?
You ought to see my Aunt March.
As Joe sits by the fireplace, Laurie picks up the blancmange.
Oh, this looks too good to eat.
It is. Meg made it. She's the oldest.
She is? Brooke and I were wondering...
Why? I mean, why should he wonder?
Well, he seems quite taken by your sister's beauty, and he wondered if there was anybody... Well, that is, anybody she liked.
Did he ask you to find out?
No, I just...
Well, you may tell him that we don't like anybody in our house. That is, we like a great many people, but... We don't like young men. We like young men, too, but we don't like young men who wonder about who else we like. Meg is too young and far too clever to bother about who wonders about her. It's ridiculous. It's all ridiculous.
Smoke rises behind Joe.
You're on fire!
Fire!
As Joe trips, falling to the floor, Laurie grabs the shovel from the fire irons rack and spanks out her smoldering backside.
Oh, clumsy of me.
He helps her up.
Quiet. Oh. Didn't mean to hurt you.
They examine her dress.
That's the second dress I've scorched this week. You see, I like to toast myself and I get too close. I think I'd better go home.
Oh, please. Please don't go home. It's dull as tombs in here.
Joe smiles.
Is that why you stand at your window looking in at us?
Oh, it's rude of me, I know. But you always seem to be having such a good time. When the lamps are lighted, it's like... looking at a picture to see all of you gathered there around the fire with your mother.
Where's your mother?
Well, she died in France shortly after my father.
I'm sorry, truly. And I give you leave to look at us whenever you like. Only why don't you come over? Then you'd be a part of the picture. And Marmy is so splendid.
Grandfather mightn't approve. You see, he doesn't believe in being neighborly. He'd say I was imposing.
Oh, bilge.
They turn to Mr. Lawrence's portrait.
He looks grim, all right.
The man overhears.
I can see how his face might frighten a lot of people. But I can't imagine being afraid of him. Of course, every time I've ever seen him, he's been barking at something.
The old man waits.
Somehow, I rather like him.
Oh.
Joe spins around.
Thank you, ma'am.
He saunters in.
And you think my face frightens people, do you?
Joe meets his glare.
Yes, sir. Frankly, I do. You understand, I don't think you mean to frighten them, but your face...
She shrugs.
Well, you ask me, sir, and yes, I do think so.
And I bark, do I?
I've heard you bark. Yes, sir. Perhaps you don't bark all the time, but you do bark. Yes, sir.
And with all that, you rather like me, do you?
Joe smiles and nods.
Yes, I do. I really do. In spite of everything.
And I like you.
They share a firm handshake.
Will you have a cup of tea?
Thank you. I had one. I was just going.
I'll walk home with you.
No, no, young man. You're staying indoors today. I will see Miss March home. I want to pay my respects to your mother. I'm afraid I've neglected my neighborly duties too long.
He dons his top hat and offers Joe his arm. She takes it and winks at Laurie. Springtime. In a classroom, Amy holds a slate bearing the words, I am ashamed of myself. Beside her, the teacher conducts. He wraps his baton on a stovepipe. Girls occupy the room's long benches and desks.
So gently, sweet afternoon,
disturb not her dream.
The teacher swishes his baton.
Class is dismissed.
The girls rise and file out past Amy. Several give her a look.
I hope this will teach you a lesson.
Amy stands still.
Stuck up thing. That'll teach you not to cut up didos.
The bespectacled teacher adjusts his cuffs.
Amy March. You may close the door.
Amy obediently steps toward the head of the door and pulls it shut. Carrying the slate with her, she faces the school teacher with imploring eyes.
Mr. Davis, if I solemnly promise not to draw any more on my slate when I'm supposed to be doing some, may I go?
Have I your promise?
Yes, sir.
Very well. Give me your slate.
Amy's eyes widen and she shakes her head.
Oh, no.
Your slate, Miss March.
Amy leans toward him.
I beg of you.
He lifts his eyebrows.
The slate.
Wilting, she slowly draws the slate from behind her back and hands it to Mr. Davis. Chalked on the reverse side is a big-nosed caricature of Davis and the caption, Young ladies, my eyes are upon you.
Did you draw this, Miss March?
I think so.
He puts the slate aside and smiles.
Hand me the ruler.
Amy's lips tremble. Her eyes drop to his desktop, and she retrieves the thick wooden ruler. She holds it out to him, and he takes it.
Hold out your hand.
Amy bares her palm.
Higher.
She lifts it.
Higher.
Closing her eyes, she stretches out her arm and remains still.
I'm ready, Mr. Davis.
With a fixed stare, he brandishes the ruler. He lowers it without striking.
You may go, Miss March.
Amy opens her eyes and gapes.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Oh, thank you, Mr. Davis.
She rushes into the coat room and joins the other girls.
What did he do?
What did he say?
Did he punish you some more?
Tell us.
Amy wheels around.
He didn't say anything. I merely told him that my mother would most certainly take me out of this miserable school. When I told her how I'd been humiliated.
She grabs her bonnet.
I told him I could not stay to discuss the matter with him, as I have to prepare for the ball I'm attending tonight, which is being given in my honor by Mr. James Lawrence, the millionaire. I told him I could not stand the degradation of being forced to attend school with a lot of ill-mannered girls who stick their silly noses into refined, elegant people's business.
Nose in the air, she struts out.
The stuck-up thing.
Now, Meg eyes a patch on Joe's bottom.
Oh, dear, it shows. I don't know what you're going to do.
I'll blend it right in. I can do it with just a few strokes of the brush.
Splendid. I'll stick to every chair in the place.
I thought if I'd pin this bow over it.
A bow? There?
I'm sorry, Joe, but you'll just have to sit on it.
Sit on one patch all evening.
She could stand if she'd keep her back to the wall.
You'd better hurry, girl.
Coming, Mommy.
Joe grabs her cape as her sisters rush out.
Oh, how I hate to be elegant.
Now, downstairs.
Oh, the dress is lovely, Meg.
Just lovely. Oh, thank you, Mommy, for letting me wear your lace and pearls.
They hug.
They're old, but you're young and very pretty.
Oh, thank you, Mommy.
Amy wears lavender.
Amy, you're perfect.
Oh, thank you, Mommy.
Beth presents herself shyly.
And Bethy.
Isn't she the pretty one?
Mommy, do I really have to go? There'll be all those people.
Oh, it would hurt Laurie's feelings if you stayed at home, and he's been so kind. Besides, dear Beth, you must learn not to be afraid of people.
All right, Mommy.
As Beth joins her sisters at the coat rack, Jo tramps down in her brown frock and cape.
Well, my shoes are too tight, and I have 19 hairpins sticking in my hair and a patch on my back, and I feel dreadful.
Where are your gloves?
Here. They're stained with lemonade. I didn't think I'd better wear them.
Why, you must. You can tell a lady by her gloves.
Meg removes a glove.
Not this lady.
A lady barehanded?
Well, you have to have gloves. You can't dance without them.
Ha! I can't dance and keep my back to the wall anyway. I'll crumple them up in my hand.
Well, here. We'll each wear one of my nice ones and carry one of your ruined ones.
All right.
Don't stretch it. Your hands are bigger than mine. Well, good night, Mommy.
Good night, dear.
Good night, Mommy.
Good night, Joe.
Good night,
Harry.
Good night,
Harry. Good night. Don't eat too much. Wait till you're asked. Don't be afraid, Bethy.
Have you all got clean handkerchiefs?
And don't put your hands behind your back. Or stare.
And don't stride about or swear. You'll disgrace me.
And don't say Christopher Columbus.
I'll be prim as a dish.
Joe leaps the fence.
Let's be elegant or die.
Oh, so boyish.
Now, in the mansion, the portrait of James Lawrence overlooks gracefully waltzing couples. Jo watches morosely from an archway, her back facing away from the party. Amid the twirling guests, Meg dances past in the arms of Mr. Brooke, who wears his dress uniform. A small orchestra plays at one end of the cleared parlor. Like most of the gentlemen, the musicians wear tuxedos. Jo sways slightly to the music as she watches the couples. Laurie, wearing tails and military trousers, waltzes by with a svelte young lady. Laurie grins broadly at Jo, who manages a friendly smile in return. Her smile fades, and she steals away into an adjoining conservatory filled with potted trees and ferns. Ornate wrought iron furniture decorates the tiled room. Jo's rhythmic swaying broadens, as does her smile. Her dress whirls out as she waltzes exuberantly. Reaching a second archway overlooking the parlor, Jo again stands still. She exchanges another grin with Laurie, whose felt partner shoots her a disdainful glance. Now on the foyer staircase, Amy and Beth peer between the balusters.
That's the biggest piano I ever saw. Why, it's bigger than our kitchen. Meg's still dancing with Mr. Brooke. I bet she's getting dizzy.
Oh, you don't get dizzy when you look straight into your partner's eyes.
Why not?
Well, because you don't see anything else. You don't see all that other stuff whirling around.
Now, a bookish young man approaches Jo.
May I engage you for this dance, Miss March? Do say yes.
Thank you, no. I don't care for dancing.
I'm enthusiastic for it.
In the foyer, Mr. Lawrence spots Beth.
Well, what are you doing there? Behind that palm.
Amy answers.
Oh, there's nobody behind that palm.
But why aren't you dancing?
Mother thinks I'm too young to dance. Besides, I'd rather mingle with my sister than mingle with the crowd.
She shifts awkwardly.
That is, if she were here.
Well, she can't see anything from there.
Oh, she doesn't want to see much. She likes to listen to the music.
Well, come on out and sit where you can hear it better.
As Beth keeps hiding, James puffs out his cheeks.
What's the matter?
Amy's eyes widen astutely.
She has an infirmity.
Oh.
She's shy.
James smiles.
I see.
If it weren't for that, she'd be simply fastidious. For she's a real artiste and plays the piano beautifully.
Oh, she'd come over here and play sometime.
Oh, she'd never do that. She doesn't play for people, just herself.
Oh, I wasn't going to listen to her. It's just that piano's going to ruin for want of use. I was hoping somebody would come and practice on it. Just to keep it in tune, you know. Oh, no one cares to come, never mind.
Beth presses her face closer.
Someone cares. Very, very much.
James smiles.
Oh, so you're the musical young lady. I didn't realize that you heard what I was saying.
I heard, sir. I'm Beth. And I'll come if no one will hear me and be disturbed.
Not a soul, my dear, not a soul. And you come too. And tell your mother that I think all her daughters are simply fastidious.
James saunters off.
Beth, isn't he perfectionary?
Beth nods. Now, as Joe sits in the sunroom, Laurie approaches.
This is the third polka, and I'm hanged if I let you refuse me again.
Please don't ask me anymore.
Why not? Don't you like to dance?
I love to, only I promised I wouldn't.
Oh, of all the silly... Why?
Why? Look.
Joe points to her backside.
Again?
Joe nods. Laurie offers his arm.
I have an idea. Come along. Come along.
Arm in arm, Laurie and Joe skirt their way around the edge of the dance floor, keeping their backs to the walls. As the couple brushes past seated guests, Joe hides the patch on her rump with her hand. Laurie ushers her around to the foyer archway.
You see, there's no one in here, and we can dance to our heart's content.
Getting into classic ballroom position, they launch into a polka. They romp across the parquet floor, unaware of Amy and Beth watching from the grand staircase. Laurie twirls Joe under his arm. Now, holding hands and swinging their arms, they dance side by side and smile at each other. They sashay forward, then cross arms and bring the dance to a close. As Joe performs a curtsy, Laurie gallantly bows and kisses her gloved hand. Amy and Beth applaud.
Christopher Columbus, we're betrayed.
Arm in arm, they march up to the girls.
What'll you girls take to keep our secret? Money or refreshments?
Thank you, we don't really care for anything.
Amy pokes Beth, then smiles sweetly.
We just had a light supper at home, because we knew the refreshments here would...
Beth elbows Amy.
Well, it's true.
I'm glad you changed your mind. Come along, Joe, we'll bring them something.
They meet a woman and her daughter.
Hello, Sally. Good evening, Mrs. Gardner. Isn't it a beautiful party?
Laurie, my dear boy, have you met my Sally?
Oh, yes, of course, many times. Excuse us, please.
They continue on their way.
Rude. Absolutely rude. That's what comes of his running around with that Josephine March. I suppose she set her cap for it.
What can you expect with four girls in a family? One of them has to marry money since they've none of their own.
Mr. James Lawrence will have something to say about that.
Amy and Beth
listen
in.
I'm sure he has other ideas for the boy. Of course, it would be a triumph for Mrs. March. I must say, she's managing the affair very well.
Amy puts her arm around her weeping sister. Now, Laurie and Joe return with desserts and lemonade. Their smiles fade.
Bethy, what happened? What's the matter?
Here, I'll take it.
Look, Beth, I brought you a beautiful lemonade.
I want to go home.
What happened? We can't tell you now. Not in front of him. She wants to go home. She's had a dreadful shock.
Joe turns to Laurie.
Will you ask Meg to come?
Of course.
Now in the sunroom, Meg and John enjoy refreshments.
But someday, when I come back, I hope to settle down in Concord. You see, Mr. Lawrence promised...
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but Joe asked me to fetch you, Miss Meg. I believe it's an emergency.
Oh, will you excuse me, please?
They rise, and Meg hurries off on Laurie's arm. As John sets down his plate, he spots a forgotten glove on Meg's chair. He picks it up, then takes a few steps into the light from the parlor. He stops and lowers his gaze to the glove. Later, in bed, Amy reaches for one of the two cherry-topped cakes resting on her lap. Beth lies beside her, sullen and still. Joe and Meg sit on the edge of the bed.
It would only upset Mommy if we told her. And there's nothing she could do about it.
Of all the base, false, slanderous...
Joe, we know. It doesn't do any good to swear about it.
Well, we can keep it from Marmy. So let's take an oath never to tell Marmy or anybody else. That horrible Mrs. Gardner. Insulting all of us. And before we had our refreshments.
Stop thinking of your stomach and take your oath.
I swear...
So do I.
They look to Meg.
And I.
Now Joe.
I solemnly vow never to breathe a word to a living soul until death.
Dead girl.
Right away, Marmy.
Meg puts a finger to her lips. She and Joe go to the door. Now, Amy picks up the second cake. Her gaze darts to Beth, lying with her eyes closed. Amy gives a little frown, then offers the cake to her sister.
Here, Beth. You take it.
Oh, thank you, Amy.
As Amy eats a few last crumbs, Beth nibbles the cake. Amy finds her clothespin, clips it to her nose, and settles into her pillow. Beth watches her closely.
You're going to have a lovely nose someday, Amy?
Yes, I know.
Beth takes another bite of cake. Meanwhile, in her robe, Marmy tucks Joe into bed and blows out the lamp. She gives her daughter a hug.
Good night, dear.
Good night, Marmy.
Marmy steps toward the bedroom door.
Marmy, you don't have any plans for us, do you?
Plans?
You know, like some mothers have for their daughters. Like wanting us to marry rich men or something.
Marmy slowly paces back toward her daughter.
Yes, Joe, I have a great many plans.
She folds her hands.
I want you all to be beautiful, accomplished, and good. I want you to be admired and loved and respected. I want you to lead pleasant and useful lives.
Marmy sits on the bed.
And I pray to the Lord to send you as little sorrow as he sees fit. Of course, I'm ambitious for you. Of course, I'd like to see you marry rich men if you love them. I'm no different from any other mother.
She pats Joe's arm.
But I'd rather see you as the happy wives of poor men. Or even respectable old maids, then queens on thrones without peace or self-respect.
Joe's eyes pool with tears and she hugs her mother.
Oh, I'm never going to get married. Never. Never.
Aren't you, my Joe?
Joe shakes her head. Marmy kisses her on the neck.
Go to sleep now.
Joe lies back and Marmy tucks her in. On her way out, Marmy glances back, then leaves, closing the door behind her. Now, in the attic, a sign on an easel reads, "The Literary Works of Josephine March, born 1846, died." Drawings of roses, birds, and a butterfly surround the words. On a trunk under the easel, a quill juts from an inkwell beside sloppily stacked notebooks. Jo sits nearby on a fainting couch. As she writes in another notebook, her eyes well up.
And yet 'tis whispered that when the gondolas glide through the fatal waters, these same waters still run crimson with the blood of Lady Viella and her gallant lover slain by the phantom hand. The end.
Joe's head drops to her knees. Beth arrives on the attic stairs holding a parcel tied with blue ribbon.
Joe! Joe!
Yes, Beth. Come in.
Beth climbs the steps and crosses the dull wood floor to her sister. Still teary-eyed, Joe holds the manuscript in her lap, rereading it.
What's the matter, Joe?
My story.
Poor Joe. Isn't it any good?
Joe wistfully shakes her head.
It's wonderful.
As Beth frowns, Joe rubs her nose.
Oh, well, Lori's waiting downstairs for you.
Oh, Bilge, I told him not to bother me.
He said he's going to wait until you come down.
Letty, I wish he'd realize I haven't time for his nonsense.
Joe spots the parcel.
What's in the package? Slippers. I made them.
Beth unwraps it.
Who for?
A gentleman.
A gentleman? What's the matter with everybody in this family?
Oh, this is an old gentleman.
Father? Huh. They won't let him wear those in the army.
Father isn't old. They're from Mr. Lawrence. He's been so kind about letting me play on that lovely piano. And in all the weeks I've been going there, I haven't even seen him.
Joe grabs the ribbon.
Say, isn't this Amy's hair ribbon?
Yes. But I think she was going to throw it away.
You think?
Joe hugs her little sister.
You're a trump.
Joe marches to the window.
Is your story finished, Joe? Can I read it?
Not now, Beth, but keep your fingers crossed and maybe you'll read it in print.
Pocketing the story, Joe climbs out the window.
Well, what'll I tell Lori?
Oh, tell him I went up and smoked.
Joe climbs down the trellis. Downstairs, Lori watches curiously as Joe's feet, pantalettes, and skirt descend past the dining room window. Carefully, Joe climbs all the way down. Only her hat remains visible above the windowsill. As her head bobs low, passing from window to window, Lori follows inside. Through the parlor window, he sees Joe break into a run, vault the fence, and dash down the road. Now, in town, two signs jut out from a brick building. One reads, Spread Eagle Publishing House, office on second floor. Beneath it, a motorized mouth the size of a wash tub opens and closes its pearly teeth. A sign hanging under the lips reads, Dr. Angus Wilkes, Extractions. Inside, Joe hurries down some stairs reading a sheet of paper. As she exits, Lori steps from behind a bulletin board on the sidewalk and catches up with her.
Did you have a bad time?
He removes his hat.
Not very.
Well, you got through quickly.
Yes, thank goodness.
Why'd you go alone?
She shoots him a look.
Didn't want anyone to know.
Oh, you're the oddest fellow I ever saw. How many did you have out?
She freezes.
How many what did I have out?
Teeth, of course.
Christopher Columbus, is that what you thought?
Well, what is it then?
They cross a bridge.
Secret?
Well, I thought we weren't going to have any secrets from each other. That's a girl for you.
Oh, Bilge. This is different.
All right, keep your secret.
Joe climbs some steps.
I've got one, too.
Something plummy?
Something very plummy.
He follows her to a riverbank.
You tell me yours, and I'll tell you mine.
Joe hands him the sheet of paper.
All right. Here. Read for yourself.
He unfolds it.
Pay to Josephine March $1. For what?
Well, turn it over.
He reads the reverse side.
In full payment for her story entitled The Phantom Hand.
Well, what do you think of that?
He grins.
$1.
Joe pockets the check.
Oh, well, it isn't much perhaps, but someday I'll get as high as $10.
Joe, I just don't understand you. Cooping yourself up in that garret, missing a lot of fun with me, working, and for what? For one measly little dollar.
It isn't the dollar. At least that's not all of it. It'll be in print, and I wrote it. And people will read it. People I've never even seen.
As they continue along the riverside, Lori fidgets with his hat.
Well, anyway, I know where Meg's glove is.
Is that your secret?
Wait till you hear where it is.
Well, where is it?
In a certain pocket.
Joe squints at him.
Whose?
Brooks. Isn't that romantic?
No. It's horrid.
You don't like it?
It's ridiculous. Of all the sickly, sentimental rubbish, I'm disgusted. I wish you hadn't told me. I'm glad Meg doesn't know about it. She'd be furious. She doesn't care about such stuff, let me tell you.
Joe sits.
She's perfectly happy with the way things are.
She folds her arms.
You'd better tell Mr. Brooke to keep away from us, or I'll let him know what I think of him. Trying to break up my family.
Lori sits beside her.
Oh, you'll feel differently, Joe, when someone falls in love with you.
He looks skyward.
On a soft summer day with the sun setting through the trees.
Lori turns to her.
And your lover's arms stealing around you.
Huh. I'd like to see anyone try it.
He takes her in his arms.
Would you?
Joe pushes him and he rolls off the rock. She runs off.
Hey!
As she runs, Lori picks himself up and gives chase. Racing across a field's edge, Joe hikes up her skirt while holding down her hat. Lori sprints after her.
I'll get you!
Joe leaps over a log.
You can't get me!
He trips on it.
Oh, yes, I can.
Flat on his face, he frowns at the log, then continues on his pursuit. Now, Joe hurdles a stone wall. Just yards behind her, Lori leaps it too and lands deftly on his feet. Up ahead, Joe's hat flies off and she stops to fetch it. Lori gains on her.
Hey!
Joe runs home. On opposite sides of the front gate, Meg stands facing John Brooke.
Open the gate! Quick!
Meg opens the gate, then slams it shut just as Laurie arrives.
I'd have caught you. I have fallen.
Joe turns to Meg.
Oh, you didn't see Laurie when he...
She stares at Mr. Brooke.
Hello, Miss Joe.
As Joe's smile fades, Meg eyes her. John turns to Meg.
Thank you for the afternoon, Meg.
Thank you, John. Paying visits has never been quite so much fun before.
I hope we can do it again soon.
Goodbye, Mr. Brooke. Come along, Meg.
Meg turns back to her guest.
Goodbye, John.
Goodbye, Meg.
John goes.
Well, goodbye, Joe.
Laurie shrugs at his stone-faced friend.
What are you mad at me for?
Hands behind her back, Joe stares at Meg. As the two women glare at each other, Laurie heads up the road behind John. Meg gazes after them, then wheels around to face Joe.
Never been so embarrassed in all my life. When are you going to stop your rude, romping ways? Not till I'm old and stiff and need a crutch. Don't try to make me grow up before my time. It's hard enough having you change all of a sudden. I haven't changed, but it's time you had. Look at you. No hairpins, no combs, running down a public road.
Joe averts her gaze.
I wish I was a horse.
Oh.
Meg storms toward the house and disappears inside. Joe turns, hands clasped behind her back, and stares at the door. Her eyes pool with tears and her lips tremble. As she stands motionless, Beth appears.
Joe!
The girl carries a basket.
Joe! Joe!
Joe turns.
Beth. Oh, Beth.
They hug.
What's the matter, Joe?
Promise me, Beth, that you'll never leave us. Promise you'll always be our Beth.
Beth, hurry up!
There's come a surprise! Right here.
Come on!
Hurry!
In the parlor! Come on!
Oh, my God. Oh, Beth, hurry!
Where can you see?
As Hannah and Amy briskly usher Beth to the parlor, Beth freezes. Meg and Marmee stand on either side of a brightly varnished upright piano. On its music stand rests an envelope with Beth's name on it. Beth's eyes sparkle.
For me?
All for you, my precious.
Amy grabs the envelope and hands it to Beth.
We haven't even opened it. Read it, read it.
Her basket still on her arm, Beth unfolds the note inside.
You read it, Joe. I can't.
Joe takes the letter.
Miss March, dear madam.
How elegant.
I have had many pairs of slippers in my life, but I never had any that suited me so well as yours. I like to pay my debts, so I know you will allow the old gentleman to send you something which once belonged to the little granddaughter he lost. With hearty thanks and best wishes, I remain your grateful friend and humble servant, James Lawrence.
Humble servant? Oh, wait till I tell that to the girls at school. Look at the cunning brackets and the silk.
Go on, honey, try it.
Let's hear the sound of the baby piano.
Beth stands still.
I have to go and thank you.
As her body turns, her eyes stay on the piano.
I'll go now.
Beth's focus catches up with her, and she walks out the door.
The piano's turned her head. She never would have gone in her right mind.
Outside, Beth passes from the gate with measured steps. The basket on her arm jostles a little as she heads next door. Slender shadows from the trees stretch across the country lane. Now, inside Mr. Lawrence's foyer, the front door opens and Beth timidly enters. The door is almost twice her size. Beth folds her hands together at her waist as she makes her way across a large Persian rug. Reaching the archway to the parlor, she stops and looks around. Beth enters the opulent room, her gait steady and unassuming. Her dress sways slightly. She passes a tall mahogany cabinet and a round table that displays silver curios and a vase of flowers. She approaches the sunroom. Inside, Mr. Lawrence sits on a wrought iron settee, reading a newspaper. Beth smiles at her silver-haired friend. Wearing a red velvet smoking jacket, he concentrates on his reading. As Beth steps closer, he lowers the newspaper and smiles. Beth's eyes glisten.
I came to thank you, sir.
She throws herself on his lap.
I came to thank you.
She hugs the venerable man and kisses his weather-beaten cheek. Mr. Lawrence wraps his arms around her, smiles, and sobs. Later, in the March's yard, Beth pours lemonade as Laurie and Joe play croquet. Amy works on a painting, and Meg visits with Mr. Brooke.
Miss March!
Hannah arrives.
Miss March! It's one of those telegraph things!
Dropping her mallet, Joe takes the telegram and runs it to her mother. Everyone gathers around Marmee as she opens the envelope.
Father.
Oh, Marmee.
He's in a hospital in Washington. I must go there at once.
Everyone follows Marmee toward the house. Now at Aunt March's house.
He's in an army hospital in Washington, and Marmee wants to leave on the 4 o'clock train. She's packing, and she sent me to ask your help. We need $25 for the fare.
I begged him not to go in the first place, but nobody listens to me. Not until they get into trouble. Then they come. Aunt March has a large pocketbook.
Oh, Aunt March, what's the use of all that? Now it's 2 o'clock and...
Just like your father. Always interrupting, refusing to listen. But you will listen this time.
No, I won't. I only came here because Marmee says she's not too proud to beg for father. Well, I am. I'm too proud to beg for anyone. I'd rather sweep the streets than ever come to you again.
Joe storms off.
Stubborn, obstinate, rude. Josephine!
Now with Marmee.
I wonder what can be keeping Joe.
Amy brings a suitcase, then Mr. Lawrence arrives.
Ah, and here's some port wine for him.
Oh, Mr. Lawrence, thank you so much. Meg, will you put them in the satchel, please?
Yes, Marmee. Here, Amy. Your gloves.
Gently. Don't shake them.
Oh, Joe.
Aunt March waddles in.
Where's that bad-tempered daughter of yours?
Aunt March, I thought she was with you.
Well, she's not. You'll need more than you asked for.
She shakes an envelope at Marmee.
Oh, Auntie.
Miss March looks inside the envelope, then hugs her aunt.
Thank you.
Now, are you sure you know how to get there? You change trains in New York, and then you...
You need feel no concern for her, ma'am. Mr. Brooke will accompany her on the journey.
Mr. Brooke? Well, there's really no need.
Mr. Lawrence has some commissions for me in Washington. And it will give me great pleasure to be of service to you.
Thank you, both.
Well, the carriage is ready. We'll wait for you outside.
With a smile, Brooke takes Marmee's bag.
How kind you are. It's such a relief to know that Marmee has someone to take care of her.
Thank you, Meg. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Beth offers tea.
Aren't you going to drink this, Marmee?
Thank you, Bethy. Girls, you won't forget the Hummels while I'm gone, will you?
I promise, Marmee.
Somebody might remember me once in a while, too. Well... I hope everything turns out for the best, but I doubt it.
Goodbye, Auntie.
Goodbye, Aunt March.
Joe nearly bumps into her.
Aunt March.
Yes, miss. And I had to get dressed and ride over here just because you're so stubborn. Goodbye.
Aunt March leaves.
Oh, Marmee.
Joe, where have you been?
What kept you so long? I must say.
Well, Aunt March croaked as she always does, and I lost my temper. So I decided to get some money on my own. Here, Marmee. This will pay for your fare.
Where did you get it?
I didn't beg, borrow, or steal it. I only sold what belonged to me.
Removing her bonnet, Jo turns around. Her hair has been cut off.
Jo!
Your hair. Jo. Your beautiful hair.
Jo faces her stunned family.
Oh, my Jo.
Oh, Jo. Your beautiful hair. You sold it.
Oh, well, it doesn't affect the fate of the nation, so don't worry about it.
Laurie arrives and gapes.
Christopher Columbus? What have you done to yourself? You look like a porcupine.
Really? I feel deliciously light and cool.
Joe steps back.
Joe.
Marmee holds Joe's arms.
Your hair will grow back. And it'll be as lovely as ever.
Marmee squeezes her.
But you'll never be more beautiful than you are now.
Looking on, Meg and Amy smile.
I like it.
So do I. It's strangely becoming. May we come to the train, Marmee?
No, dear. I want you to stay here and go on with your work.
The girls follow Marmee to the door. Laurie brushes past them.
Goodbye, my darlings.
Goodbye, Marmee.
Marmee joins the three men at the carriage, then turns and looks back.
God bless and keep us all.
As she boards the carriage, the daughters sadly watch from the doorway. Joe wraps an arm around Beth, Meg rests her hand on Amy's shoulder, and Amy gently grips Beth's arm. Now, on a rainy day, Laurie and Joe sit in the attic chomping apples. As Joe reclines on the fainting couch, Laurie sits on a table with his feet on the trunk.
Work. I don't see why you want to work.
She opens a small black coffer and takes out two bills.
Money.
Well, I've got plenty of that if you ever need it.
He bites into his apple.
And something else. A sort of nervous feeling. I like it.
She drops the bills in the coffer.
Joe! Joe, Laurie! Joe, hurry! Joe, hurry!
Downstairs, Amy and Meg look up imploringly. Beth leans against the door.
Don't come near me, Joe.
Beth, what is it?
The baby's dead. The baby's dead. The Hummel baby died, Joe.
Oh, my poor Beth.
I tried to warm her feet, but she was so cold and lay so still. And then I knew that she was dead. And the doctor came and he said it was scarlet fever.
Amy starts toward Beth.
Oh, Beth.
Come and lie down. Keep away from me, Amy. You've never had it either. I feel so funny.
Beth collapses. Joe, Meg, and Mr. Brooke rush over. Later, as Beth lies motionless in bed, a white-haired doctor in a black suit stands over her. Meg and Joe watch from either side of the bed. The physician strokes his chin, then glances at Joe as he steps toward the door. Meg and Joe trade a woeful look. As Joe follows the doctor out, Meg remains seated at the foot of the bed. In the hallway, Mr. Lawrence faces the doctor.
How is she?
Again, he strokes his chin.
Can't anyone say? How is she?
I'd expected the fever to turn by now, but...
Laurie looks on.
She doesn't even know us anymore.
If Mrs. March could be sent for...
The doctor paces.
Meg wrote out a telegram days ago, and we wouldn't let her send it, not... Oh, Marmee!
As Joe runs into the attic, Laurie follows. On the darkened stairwell, Joe leans heavily on the newel post. Laurie stops behind her.
Oh, just me. She doesn't even know us.
Hold on to me, Joe. Marmee will be here.
Oh, no, she won't. How can she?
I got fidgety and sent for her yesterday. She'll be here on the 5 o'clock train this morning.
Marmee? Here? In a few hours?
Yes, Joe.
Joe hugs him.
Oh, Laurie, dear Laurie.
She kisses him on both cheeks, then draws away.
Oh, I didn't mean to fly at you like that. But you're such an angel, and I don't know how to thank you.
Laurie grins.
Fly at me again.
Oh, Laurie, could it be that we'll laugh again and have fun again?
I hope so, Joe. Well, to the railroad station. I shan't spare the horses.
Bless you, Laurie. Bless you.
Laurie descends the stairs. Now, at the sickbed, Meg and Mr. Lawrence sit watching Beth. Joe peers out the window, then takes a seat. Hannah sits in a chair behind Meg, who looks up dolefully.
God spare us, Beth. I will never complain again.
If life is as hard as this, I don't know how we shall ever get through it.
Beth stirs. The women rush to the bed.
What is it?
Dr. Barnes.
Mr. Lawrence rushes out.
Dr. Barnes!
Dr. Barnes comes to the bed. He leans over and, checking Beth's pulse with one hand, rests the other upon her forehead. With his thumbs, he gently lifts Beth's right eyelid, then the left. Now, Dr. Barnes stands up straight and faces the worried family.
My dears, I think the little girl's going to pull through, after all.
Oh,
now keep the house quiet, dear. Let her sleep. When she wakes, give her some warm milk.
Milk!
Oh, Meg!
Get some milk.
Marmee arrives.
Milk!
The women embrace.
Marmee. She'll be well.
Marmee rushes to the bedside.
Tell her everything will be all right. With Marmee, you're home.
Joe and Meg hold each other behind Marmee.
Bethy.
Now Meg and Joe carry a conscious Beth downstairs.
Don't drop her.
Amy follows with a pillow.
I made a will when you were sick, Beth.
You made a will.
You needn't laugh. I left you my plaster rabbit and my bronze inkstand. After all, you lost the cover to it. I left Lori my clay model of a horse. Even though he did say it didn't have a neck.
Amy puts down a kitten.
There.
Hannah and the others tuck Beth in on the couch.
It's so wonderful to be downstairs again. Everything so beautiful. Flowers and the sun.
Mr. Lawrence sent the flowers. I ordered the sun.
I willed you all my clothes, Mommy.
That was sweet of you, dear.
Of course, as I didn't die, no one gets anything.
Beth smiles, too.
Begging your pardon, ladies, but do the Marches live here?
They do indeed. All of them.
I have a package for them.
A uniformed man with a black mustache enters.
Father!
The family embraces. He kisses them each in turn.
Oh, Father!
Meg.
Oh, Father.
Marmee patiently awaits.
My dear.
They embrace. Mr. March gives Hannah his black army coat, then cups her face in his hands.
Hannah.
He looks to Beth.
And now, my Beth.
He kneels and hugs her. Marmee, oh. Meg, and Amy gather around. As Lori looks on, Joe grins broadly.
Well, now I guess the March family are all together again. I call this splendid. I do, really.
Later, Meg comes downstairs to the parlor in a broadly striped dress. Its long sleeves are cuffed with thin white ruffles. The collar is encircled by a pink ribbon. Meg wears rouge and carries a small bouquet of flowers. Setting them down, she faces a mirror over the fireplace and puts a pink blossom in her hair. Joe approaches her.
Where are you going?
Going? Nowhere.
You must be expecting someone then.
I?
Yes, you.
As Meg pats the newly added flower in her hair, Joe paces up behind her.
Are you expecting that man?
I don't know what you're talking about. If you mean Mr. Brooke.
He's the only one who comes here. I hope you don't think you're in love with him, because I can tell you that you're not.
Meg swings around to face Joe.
I'm not?
No, you can't be. Now you see, Meg, I'm a writer. And I write about girls who are in love, so I know. You have none of the symptoms. You eat all right, you sleep like a log, you're not twittery or cross, and you don't mope in corners. Therefore, you're not in love. Therefore, don't go and marry that man.
I don't intend to go and marry any man.
You don't? Hurrah for you! You're a trump. And what will you say to him when he comes around begging for your hand?
Well, of course he may not come around. But if he does, I shall say quite calmly and decidedly, thank you, Mr. Brooke. You are very kind. But I quite agree with Marmee that I am too young to enter into any engagement at present. So please say no more, but let us be friends as we were.
Good. That's stiff and cool enough. And then when you hand him the mitten, things will be the way they were around here. And
they look across the parlor. As Meg lowers her eyes, Joe rushes to the window.
Meg, it's him. I'll get out of the way. Now, don't forget. Oh, if I could only see his face when you tell him.
Joe dashes out of the room. Meg checks her hair in the mirror, then steps from the parlor. Pausing in the entryway, she opens the door.
Good afternoon. I came to get my umbrella. That is, I came to see how your father finds himself today.
Well, come in. He's in the rack. I'll get him and tell it you're here.
She gets the black umbrella from the stand.
What's the matter, Meg? Are you angry with me?
How could I be when you've been so kind to Marmee? I only wish I could find a proper way to thank you.
Shall I tell you how?
Please don't. I'd rather not.
Meg, please listen to me.
He takes her hand.
I love you so. And even if you don't love me now, maybe you could learn to.
Meg yanks her hand free.
I don't choose to learn. Please go away and let me be.
Do you really mean that?
She forces a nod.
Yes, I do.
Won't you even think about it?
Just go away.
Please go away.
He embraces her.
Oh, Meg.
Aunt March enters. Her eyebrows pop up.
What's this?
Brooke dashes off.
What's going on here?
Meg backs against the doorway.
He's just a friend of Father's. I'm so surprised to see you, Aunt March.
So that's evident. What mischief is going on here? I insist upon knowing. Who is this young man? Mr. Brooke?
Yes, Mr. Brooke.
The Lawrence boys' tutor? Did he dare propose to you?
Oh, please, Aunt March, he'll hear you.
Have you accepted him?
Please.
Well, now, let me tell you, miss, that if you marry this hook or rook or cook, not a penny of my money goes to you. Do you understand?
I shall marry who I please, Aunt March. And I don't care anything about your money.
It is your duty to marry a rich man and help your family, Miss Independence. And you may be sure that this hook knows that you have a rich relation, me. And that's why he wants to marry you.
How dare you say such a thing? Why, my John would no more marry for money than I would.
Very well, do as you please. No one takes my advice. But remember, the day that you marry him, I shall disinherit you. And now you've even made me forget what I came for.
She wraps her cane on the floor, then toddles out. Her dress gets pinched in the door. Now John comes out of hiding.
Oh, Meg, darling. Thank you for defending me and proving that you do care.
I didn't know how much until she said those dreadful things.
Darling, will you wait for me?
As they embrace passionately, Jo saunters in. Her grin drops. She runs upstairs and bursts in on Marmee, who sits peddling the sewing machine, stitching fabric.
Marmee, do something. Go downstairs, quick. John Brooke is acting dreadfully, and Meg likes it.
Later, John and Meg kneel at their wedding.
As they have given and pledged their troth, each to the other, and have declared the same by giving and receiving a ring and by joining hands, I pronounce that they are man and wife. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Ghost. Amen.
Later, on the lawn, Beth plays her upright piano. Aunt March, Mr. Lawrence, and Marmee stand around her. Dancing guests of all ages hold hands and circle the newlyweds. Jo stands off to the side, her face melancholy. As the ring of guests closes and opens around the couple, Laurie looks up from his place in the dance circle. He notices Jo by herself, and his smile fades. As Jo walks off, leafy shadows play across her buttery yellow dress. Back in the circle of dancing guests, Laurie looks around for her.
Excuse me.
The young man leaves the circle. Wearing white gloves and a cream-colored suit, he steps toward the turnstile. Across the road, Jo meanders down a woodland path between patches of wildflowers and ferns. Her slow steps take her to an ivy-covered tree. As she sits by it, her long dress billows out a little. Jo hugs her knees and leans back against the tree trunk. A few yards behind her, Laurie follows the wooded path. On one side, clustered trees obscure a view of a rolling meadow and distant mountain. As Laurie approaches Jo, he gingerly removes his gloves and steps up beside her.
Don't feel too badly, Jo.
He sits beside her.
You still got me. I'm not good for much, I know, but...
He rests a hand on hers.
I'll stand by you all the days of my life.
She strokes his bare hand.
I know you will.
Their gazes meet.
You don't know what a comfort you are to me, Laurie.
He lowers his lips to her gloved fingers, then brushes them with his cheek.
Jo, will you listen to what I want to tell you?
No, Laurie. Don't say it.
Oh, I will, and you must hear me. It's no use, Jo. We've got to have it out, and the sooner the better for both of us.
Her eyes glisten with tears.
Say what you like, then. I'll listen.
I've loved you ever since I've known you, Jo. Couldn't help it. I've tried to show you, but you wouldn't let me. Now I'm going to make you hear and give me an answer.
She shakes her head.
Oh, I wanted to save you this, Laurie. I never wanted you to care for me, so...
Their eyes meet.
I tried to keep you from it when I could.
And I only loved you more for it. Oh, I know I'm not good enough for you, Jo, but...
She studies his earnest gaze.
Well, if you love me, you can make me anything you like.
Oh, Laurie, I wouldn't change you.
She looks away sadly.
You should marry a lovely, accomplished girl who adores you. Someone who would grace your beautiful home and give you the sort of life you really want. I wouldn't. I loathe elegant society, and you hate my scribbling, and I can't get on without it. I know we would quarrel.
No, we wouldn't.
We always have, you know. Everything would be horrid if we were ever foolish enough to...
Marry? Oh, no, it wouldn't, Joe. It would be heaven. Besides, everyone expects it. Grandfather has his heart set on it. So don't disappoint us. Oh, I just can't go on without you, Joe.
She gazes at him, and they embrace.
Oh, Laurie. Laurie, I'm so sorry. So desperately sorry. But I can't say I love you when I don't.
He pulls himself from her embrace and gazes into her eyes.
Really and truly, Joe.
Really and truly, Laurie.
Letting her hands drop from his shoulders, she leans back.
I don't think I'll ever marry.
She looks off solemnly.
Oh, yes, you will. I know you will. Someday you'll change, you'll meet some good-for-nothing, no-account fool, and you'll fall in love with him and work and live and die for him. I know you will, because it's just your way. And I'll have to stand by and see it. Well, I'll be hanged if I do.
As he stomps off, Joe springs up.
Laurie! Laurie, where are you going?
To the devil!
Laurie!
He heads up the path.
Laurie.
Later, Marmee stands by Joe's bed.
Are you very lonely, my Joe?
Joe sits on the mattress in her nightgown.
I think I must be.
She absently opens and closes a lace fan.
You know, Joe, when you were little girls, I used to ask myself, what will become of Meg, Beth, and Amy? I've worried about Meg's longing for wealth, Beth's timidity, Amy's selfish little ways. But I never worried about you. You always seemed so sure of yourself. But lately, I find myself thinking of you more than the others. You often seem sad.
I'm not sad, Marmee, exactly. I've been thinking. I'd like to go away someplace. Amy could take care of Aunt Marge, and you'll have Beth, and if I could try my wings, maybe...
You think so, Joe? Perhaps you should go.
Joe smiles to herself.
I'd go to New York. I've always wanted to go to New York. Why, they have the finest libraries and theaters there. And I could work for Mrs. Kirk, taking care of her children. And write in my spare time.
Marmee caresses Joe's shoulder.
I'll talk it over with Father. We'll write to Mrs. Kirk. Might be good for you.
Joe stands.
Oh, it would. Laurie'd get over me while I'm gone, and when I come back, we'll be just the same as we used to be.
Marmee embraces her and gazes off over Joe's shoulder.
Of course, my darling.
She kisses her on the temple, then meets her gaze.
You're on to bed now. Good night, dear.
She kisses Joe's cheek.
Good night, Marmee.
Later, a sign on a brick building reads, Mrs. Kirk's excellent table, rooms and board. A woman brings Joe into a front hall.
Now make yourself at home. I'm on the drive from morning to night, as you may well suppose, with such a family. But I promised your mother I wouldn't let you get homesick, and Sophie will show you to your room. Sophie! Your evenings will be free, and I fixed up your own room just as comfortable as possible with a nice table for your writing. Sophie! Now, there are some very nice people in my house, but it's also a great load off my mind to know that you'll be with the children. Now I must run and change my cap for tea. Sophie! Oh.
A skinny young woman peeks out from the top of a long staircase. She lumbers down the stairs. Joe waits with a suitcase in each hand and an umbrella tucked under her arm.
Sophie, this is Miss Josephine, the new governess. Will you take her up to her room?
Thank you, Mrs. Kirk.
Make yourself at home, child.
As Mrs. Kirk hurries away, Sophie leads Joe upstairs. The servant's arms, drooping at her side, swing lightly as she bumbles along.
I've never been in New York before. I've been looking forward to it. You see, I'm a writer.
and I need the experience. New impressions. A writer should meet and study people. Search their souls. Figure out their problems. Oh, I know I'm going to love New York. I've always wanted to come here.
Kitty! Tina!
Two girls wearing feathered headdresses run into the hallway. As the girls run into Joe, a brown bear crawls out after them.
Professor!
It's a man wearing a bearskin rug.
Oh, I beg your pardon. I'm so sorry.
This is Miss Josephine Children, who's got you in charge now.
Hello.
This is Professor Bear.
How do you do?
Come on, let's finish the game.
Now, that's for Miss Josephine to say.
I am afraid we've frightened her already.
Oh, no, please go on with your game.
Thank you.
Joe bends over and picks something up.
You've lost a button off your vest.
Thank you very much. Let's go now, eh? This time you'll be the general. No. Eh?
As Bear leaves with the children, Sophie smiles.
Oh, he's such a lovely man.
Who is he?
Well, I know he must have been a real gentleman at one time or another, but he's as poor as a church mouse now.
What does he do?
Oh, he's a professor. See, he learns them how they talk in foreign countries, but I don't see what good it does them when they're living right here.
Later, Joe sews beside the children's beds.
And then Goldilocks did what?
Kitty's awake.
And then Goldilocks saw three chairs. One was...
a great, huge chair.
And the other was what?
A nice, comfortable, medium-sized chair.
And the third was a little bitty chair.
That's right. What happened then?
So she sat in the big chair, and it was too hard. Too hard. Too hard. I'll see you the rest later.
Kitty rolls over.
Can you wait?
Yes, Kitty. I can wait.
Joe stands and kisses Kitty's temple.
Right.
Joe tucks the child's blanket firmly under the mattress. Fetching her sewing box, she turns down the lamp and carefully opens the door. Out in the hallway, she stops at the head of the stairs.
Lass ich leider, allein und abgetrennt von aller Freude.
She looks down to the lower landing of the staircase, then descends. Joe follows the music to a sitting room where she pauses between an archway's gold velvet curtains. Joe enters and sits.
Seh ich ans Firmament, mach jener Seite.
Professor Bear, wearing his glasses and a smoking jacket, sits at the keyboard. Joe's gaze grows wistful as she listens.
Ist in der Weite.
Now she leans dreamily back in the cushioned chair.
Die Sehnsucht kennt, weiß, was ich leide.
The music pulls Joe's posture forward. Bear sees her.
Oh!
Oh, please don't stop. It's so beautiful.
Thank you very much.
What is that song? I've heard you play it before, and I'd like to send it to my sister.
It's called Nur wer die Sehnsucht kennt. The words are by Goethe. Do you understand German?
No, I don't.
Bear sheepishly drops his eyes.
Then I'll try to say them for you in English. Let's see now. Nur wer die Sehnsucht kennt. Only who knows what longing is.
He meets her distant gaze.
Weiß, was ich leide, can know what I suffer.
Joe stares off enrapt.
Allein und alone and parted far from joy and gladness.
As Joe lowers her eyes, Bear focuses on the keyboard. Joe's faraway gaze turns to him, then rises anew. Her tear-filled eyes sparkle like jewels as she leans on the piano.
My senses fade a burning fire devours me.
Bear shakes his head, punctuating the uttered words. Joe's lips part.
My senses fail. A burning fire devours me. Oh, if only I could write something like that.
She grins.
Something that would set other hearts on fire.
Bear stands.
You truly like to write, then?
Oh, I love it. Writing is my life. Oh, I've scribbled ever since I was a child. Some of my stories have been published. I just sold one to the Weekly Volcano. Oh, it's a wonderful one about... Well, I won't tell you what it is, but you must read it yourself.
The Weekly Volcano? You must forgive my ignorance. But what is that?
Her eyes widen.
Why, it's a magazine.
He nods, then smiles.
The story I just sold is the best I've done.
Since we seem to share a mutual interest in writing and music, would you allow me to take you to the opera or the theater sometime?
She smiles sweetly.
I should love it.
She looks at his vest.
Oh, please don't think me rude. But as long as you're not going to sew on that button, will you let me do it?
I was going to, but I couldn't find a button.
She gets a needle from her sewing box.
You put it right there.
Oh.
See?
Oh, thank you.
Sit down, please.
He backs into a chair. Joe follows and kneels before him, sewing the button on his vest. They exchange a smile.
You are very kind.
Now, in a gilded theater balcony, Joe sits beside Bear and peers down through opera glasses. In the front hall of Mrs. Kirk's boarding house, the door opens. Joe dances in, waving her fan.
Oh, it was wonderful. Magnificent. Just like heaven.
Are you happy, my little friend?
Oh, it was divine. I don't want to be a writer anymore. I want to sing.
She dances across the Persian carpet.
Thrill millions of people with my beautiful voice. Audiences will cheer me, throw flowers at my feet.
Bravo! But I wouldn't make up my mind too soon. After the art museum, you wanted to be a sculptress. After the circus, you thought the bareback rider was the most beautiful thing in the world.
I know. But to sing like that, oh, nothing could be more wonderful.
As she dances upstairs, Bear chases after her.
We will wait at the house.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, there's something inside of me tonight that makes me want to shout.
And what would you shout?
Oh, I'd say, look at me, everybody. I'm Josephine March, and I'm so happy.
She sits on the stairs.
Then, perhaps you haven't missed your home so much lately, or your old friends?
Joe smiles under his gaze.
No, I haven't. And you alone are responsible for that.
He sits by her.
Thank you, my little friend. You know, I've seen Martha many times before, in Vienna, in Milan, but never have I enjoyed it so much. Now I know why. Before, I've gone alone. Tonight I went with you. There is no greater pleasure than to hear or see something beautiful with someone.
He bashfully lowers his eyes.
Someone who...
Oh, Miss Josephine.
Kitty, you should be asleep.
I want to tell you a story.
No story. Back to bed.
Once upon a time, there were three bears.
As Joe disappears up a second flight of stairs with Kitty, Bear hangs his head. Later, Joe sits writing. Sophie enters.
Miss Josephine.
Yes, Sophie.
There's company in the parlor for you.
Joe spins to her feet.
Company? Who could it be, I wonder?
Surprise.
As Joe takes off her apron, Sophie spies two periodicals.
Are these your new stories?
She picks them up.
Oh, they look creepier than the Duke's daughter.
Can I read them, please?
Yes, of course.
As Joe leaves, Sophie wanders to a comfortable chair.
The place of the coffin tree, or the secrets of a guilty heart. By Josephine March.
Now, Joe finds Amy and Aunt March in the sitting room. Amy wears a fitted coat with plaid trim.
Amy! Amy!
Joe!
Oh, Joe!
Aunt Marge! Oh, Amy, I've never been so surprised.
Joe, you're thin, Josephine.
Amy, you look lovely.
Aunt Marge bought me this coat. Do you like it?
Oh, I love it. Sit down, sit down. Tell me everything. What are you here for?
Well, what kind of a place is this? Why haven't you had supper?
Oh, Aunt Marge, nobody has supper till 7 o'clock in New York. Tell me now, when did you get to town?
1 hour and 5 minutes ago, and we're in a hurry. We have to get to the shipping office before it closes.
Shipping office?
Surprise lights up Jo's face, and she falls to her knees at Aunt March's feet.
Oh, Aunt March, Europe!
Yes, Jo, Europe.
Oh!
I'm sailing tomorrow on the Britannia, and I'm taking Amy with me.
Jo glances to Amy, then her sad eyes turn to Aunt March.
Well, maybe you can go the next time.
Jo slowly rises to her feet and then goes to her sister.
Oh, Amy, I'm glad for you.
Oh, I know I promised to take you, but Amy and I get along famously. And I never did get along with you.
Jo forces a smile.
It's all right, Aunt March. I'm happy for Amy. Oh, it'll be thrilling for her. Besides, I'm having a wonderful time. Theaters, operas, lectures. And I know Amy is a much better companion than I could ever hope to be. Tell me, how's Bethy and Marmy and Meg and Father?
Oh, they're all fine. Except Beth. She's not well, Jo.
Jo frowns and shakes her head.
Oh, my poor Beth. She must get well. She must.
You know that Meg is expecting. Dreadful, isn't it?
Jo smiles and faces Amy.
Yes, I knew she was. I think it's wonderful. And, how's Laurie?
Amy gapes.
Laurie?
She looks blankly at Jo.
Well, didn't you see him when he was here? He and Mr. Lawrence sailed for Europe 3 weeks ago.
Jo takes a seat.
Laurie? In New York? And he didn't come to see me?
Well, you cannot blame him after the way you picked up and trotted off without so much as a goodbye. Come along, Amy. We mustn't miss the shipping office. Goodbye, Josephine. Maybe the next time I go.
Bye. Jo.
Amy takes Jo's hands.
Oh, I wish you were going. I know how you've always longed to go. Oh, no, darling. I'm perfectly contented here. It's your reward. You've always done sweet things to please Aunt March. And, oh, think of all the wonderful things you're going to see. The Turners, the Raphael's, the Leonardo's.
Amy, you seem to forget that hansom cabs cost money. Now, that's the trouble with people who never had anything. Come easy, go easy. Bye, Josephine.
Goodbye, Aunt March.
Jo embraces Amy.
Goodbye, Amy. Goodbye. Write to me often. I will, Jo, dear.
Amy lowers her head and starts to leave. She stops and swings back around.
Jo, if I should see Laurie, do you want me to give him a message from you? Or anything?
Jo looks away with a smile.
Just tell him I love him. Like a sister.
Amy's face brightens.
Do you really mean that, Jo?
And I wish he'd find a beautiful girl and settle down.
The sisters embrace tightly.
Goodbye, my darling Jo.
Goodbye, little Amy. Have a wonderful trip.
Amy turns and leaves. Jo closes the door behind her, pausing for a last look through the crack. Shutting it all the way, she leans her back to the door and frowns, crestfallen. Later, as she climbs the stairs past Bear's room, the professor sees her through his open doorway. Bear jumps up and removes his eyeglasses.
Miss Josephine?
Yes, Professor Bear.
I have read your story in the volcano. I'd like to talk to you about it. Will you please come in?
Oh, yes. Thank you.
She slowly walks into his room. With a serious look, he follows her, leaving the door open and gets the magazine.
Sit down. Won't you, Miss Josephine?
As she sits on a couch, Bear remains standing.
I have read your stories.
Oh, did you like them?
I must be honest with you. I was disappointed. Why do you write such artificial characters? Such contrived plots. The Duke's vengeance, villains, murderers, fainting women.
Joe sobs into the arm of the couch. Bear hastens to her side.
Oh, Miss Josephine, please. Oh, I am so sorry. I didn't want to hurt you. I want to help you. What a blundering fool I am.
He gives her his handkerchief.
Don't pay any attention to me. This has nothing to do with you. It's just that everything happens at once. The rest doesn't matter so much. I can bear that. But, Laurie, I can never get over Laurie.
Oh, Laurie, your friend. Something has happened to him?
Yes. Oh. Well, nothing happened to him exactly.
She looks up at Bear.
Something's happened to me. He came to New York and he didn't even come to see me.
Bear shakes his head.
What a fool he must be.
Oh, no. It's my fault. Only I thought...
She paces.
Oh, what does it matter what I thought? I've made a mess of it as I do with everything. But I've tried. And when I think of Aunt March taking Amy to Europe with her when she always promised she'd take me... Oh, not that I begrudge Amy the trip, but... Well, I suppose that's what I am doing.
The trip to Europe you have so looked forward to. That is a cruel disappointment. I know. And then, on top of it, a stupid professor comes blundering and makes things worse.
Oh, no. If I can't stand the truth, I'm not worth anything.
She wipes her tears with her hand.
Well, I didn't think those stories were very good, but...
She smiles.
You see, the Duke's daughter paid the butcher bill, and the curse of the Coventrys was the blessing of the Marches.
Yes, that is what I thought. And then I said to myself, I maybe have no right to speak. But then I said to myself, I maybe have no right not to speak. For you have a talent.
You really think so?
Otherwise, I would not say it. You know that. And I say to you, sweep mud in the street first before you are false to that talent. Say to yourself, I will never write one single line which I have not first felt in my own heart. Say to yourself, while I am young, I will write the simple, beautiful things I know and understand. Will you do that, my little friend?
Her gaze settles and grows pensive.
I'll try.
She squares her jaw.
I'm going home.
Home?
It's where I belong. They need me there. Beth is sick and I can help my family.
But then you will not be here. I will not see you.
His eyes drop.
Whom will I go to the opera with?
He smiles and fingers his vest.
Who will sew on my buttons when you are gone?
She studies his face.
I may be back someday. And I'll write you, truly I will.
You will write. But go, Josephine. Go back to your home and write your stories as you can write them. And maybe someday I will see you there. Your home.
Now, in the March family's parlor, lightning flashes through the wooden shutters. As a lamp burns on a table, Marmee sits with Beth raveling yarn. Beth lies on the couch, the yarn spooled on her pale, outstretched hands.
Oh, the winter's been so long. I wish the spring would come.
Marmee loosens a bit of yarn from Beth's hands and resumes raveling. Beth closes her eyes. Joe arrives with a travel bag and a gift.
Joe! Joe!
Marmee!
Oh, you're back.
Oh, Marmee, it's so wonderful to be home.
Oh, the house has been empty without you.
Joe sees Beth.
Oh, Joe.
Joe rushes to her.
Bethy, my Beth.
Joe embraces her frail sister.
Oh, Beth.
Beth smiles into Joe's eyes.
I was wishing that spring would come, Joe. And it has.
Oh. Joe kisses her on the cheek.
Oh, I have so many things to tell you. Very plummy, too. And so many things to ask. But presents first.
The gift-wrapped box is the size of a pound of butter. Joe unwraps it. It's a music box.
This is for you, Bethy.
Thank you, Joe.
It can accompany you while you play.
Beth looks up.
I don't play much now, Joe. Not at all, really.
Beth opens the box's glass lid. Joe rises and faces Marmee.
Where's Father?
In his study, dear. He'll be so glad that you're home.
Her coat still on, Joe turns and leaves the room. Now in the study.
And that's all, Joe. Dr. Barnes says there's nothing we can do.
Oh, no, Father. Not Beth.
These will be dark days for us, Joe. For you especially.
He holds her arms.
Now dry your eyes, my child, for her sake. Don't let her see you cry.
He pulls Joe into an embrace. Joe nods, then turns and leaves. Her father stands watching. Later, in the attic, Joe lies on the fainting chair, her knuckles pressed to her lips. As a lamp burns on a trunk behind her, Beth approaches in her nightgown and robe.
Don't cry, Joe.
She leans on the trunk.
I don't want you to cry for me.
Joe pushes herself up and faces Beth.
I'm not crying for you, darling.
Joe looks away.
I'm just lonesome for Meg and Amy. And for our old happy times. I guess the storm didn't help things either. I'll be all right.
Bracing herself on the trunk, Beth moves closer and sits beside Joe. Dark circles rim the young girl's eyes.
It's no use, Joe. I know. Please don't tell Mommy, but I know. Oh, Joe, you mustn't be afraid.
Beth rests a hand on Joe's arm.
Doesn't it sound funny? Me saying that to you, when you've always said it to me. You've always reminded me of a seagull, Joe. Strong and wild, and fond of the wind and storm, and dreaming of flying out to sea. And Marmee said I was the cricket on the hearth, content to stay at home. I can't express it very well. I guess I shouldn't even try, except to my Joe. But it seems I was never intended to live very long. I never planned what I would do when I grew up, like the rest of you did. Because I could never bear the thought of leaving home. But I'm not afraid anymore, Joe. I've learned that I won't lose you, that nothing can really part us, though it seems to. And that we'll always be a family. Even though one of us is gone. But Joe, I think that I will be homesick for you. Even in heaven.
Joe turns away. As she presses her tearful face into the cushion, Beth keeps a firm hold on Joe's arm. The sickly girl gazes peacefully at her older sister. Later, on the cover of a stack of simply bound pages, a feminine hand writes with a pencil, "My Beth." A novel by Josephine March. Joe's hands withdraw, leaving the manuscript untouched on a wicker stool. As she opens it to the first page and writes, autumn leaves fall lightly around her.
Dedicated to my sister, Beth, who is now parted from me.
Jo sits in the yard with her long russet skirt spread around her on the grass.
Jo! Jo!
Meg arrives in a one-horse carriage.
Well, it isn't the elegant young matron. How are the twins?
Wonderful, Jo. What's that?
My novel. Finished. I'm sending it off. You can read it when it comes back.
Maybe they'll publish it.
Oh, I'm not sending it to a publisher. I'm sending it to Professor Bear. I sort of promised it to him once.
As Joe grins, Meg frowns.
Well, that's an odd thing to do. You write him often, don't you?
Yes, I do. And he knows what I'm writing about. I mean, he understands me. And why shouldn't I write to him?
He writes me. I think it's splendid.
We had a letter from Amy. They're in Valrosa now. And she says it's paradise.
I know. She wrote me, too. They should be on their way home soon. Joe, I've been wondering, how would you feel if you heard that Laurie was learning to care for someone else?
Joe smiles.
Who, Meg? Amy?
Yes, Joe.
Joe grins and shakes her head.
Then I wouldn't mind at all. How could I?
Well, I wasn't sure. Forgive me, Joe. It's just that, you know, you seem so alone. I thought that if Laurie came back,
oh, no.
You might...
No, it's better the way it is. But you're right about me being alone. I am lonely. And who knows, maybe if Laurie had come back, I might have said yes. Oh, not that I love him any differently, but because, well, it means more to me to be loved now than it used to. Well, I suppose they'll get married and live happily ever after.
I suppose they will. Well, if you're going to the post office, I'll...
Thank you, Meg, but I'd rather walk.
Goodbye, Joe.
Goodbye, Meg.
Meg snaps the reins and the carriage rolls away. Joe stands watching, her manuscript in her arms. Later, as a gentle shower spatters the attic window panes, four leather-strapped trunks sit in a row. Each is labeled with hammered-in tacks that form letters. The first reads, Meg. The next, Beth. Then, Amy. And lastly, Joe. Seated on the floor beside them, Joe leaves through a pile of drawings.
Come in.
It's Laurie.
Anna?
Laurie steps closer.
Marmy?
Joe puts Amy's old drawings away.
Who is it?
Laurie grins.
Laurie.
They embrace.
Oh, Laurie, my blessed boy. When did you get back? Where's Amy? Your wife?
Downstairs. We just got here.
Oh, I can't wait to see her.
Joe.
Laurie stops her.
Joe, dear. I want to say one thing, and we'll put it by forever.
As their eyes lock, Joe slowly shakes her head.
You don't need to say it, Laurie. It was always meant to be this way. And it would have come about anyway, if you'd only waited.
I know. You tried so hard to make me understand.
But you were so impatient and stubborn.
Well, now that everything came about the way you wanted it, it'll be like old times again.
Joe's smile fades.
No, Laurie.
She lets go of his hands.
The old days can never come back. We can't be playmates any longer. We're man and woman now. But we can be brother and sister. And love each other and help each other for the rest of our lives.
Yes, Joe. For the rest of our lives.
They smile. Then Joe takes his hand.
Come on. I want to kiss your bride.
Downstairs, John and Meg hold twin babies.
Yeah. Cookie? There you are.
Hannah offers one to John. Nearby, Mr. and Mrs. March, Aunt March, and Mr. Lawrence have tea.
Wonderful tea, eh? Wonderful.
Coming home on a day like this, after all the money I spent on my rheumatism. Doctors, baths.
Amy enters.
Where is Joe? Where are they?
Wearing a lavish gown, Amy nibbles a cookie, then rushes out.
Joe! Joe! Oh,
Amy!
Joe! Oh, my Joe! Oh, I'll never forgive myself for staying away and leaving all the burdens to you.
Oh, you're so beautiful. And to think that only yesterday you were such a horrid little girl.
As Joe ushers Amy off, Lori's smile fades.
Aunt March! Mr. Lawrence! Welcome home.
Left alone on the stairs, Laurie drops his eyes. Now, out in the rain, a man wearing a caped coat and holding an umbrella walks to the March's front door. Laurie answers the door. It's Professor Bear.
Oh, is Miss March in? Mrs. Josephine March?
She is. Won't you come in?
Bear looks through the crack in the door and sees the family gathering in the parlor.
Oh, no. No, thank you. She has guests.
Laurie, where are you? Come and get your tea.
Just a minute, Joe.
Bear looks at Laurie with surprise and understanding.
Will you give this to her, please?
He hands Laurie a wrapped package.
Thank you.
With a nod, Bear turns back toward the road. Laurie watches the man leave, closes the door, and returns to the parlor.
You know, in Europe, one feels that dirt is so picturesque.
Joe pours tea.
Here you are, my lad.
Thank you. This is for you, Joe.
Why, thank you, Laurie.
Oh, it isn't for me.
Joe looks at the package, then at Amy.
What?
We'll open it. Don't just look at it.
Laurie and Amy watch Joe unwrap a thin red book. The cover reads, My Beth by Josephine March.
Joe, your book.
Oh, can Joe. You believe it?
Published.
Who left it?
A man with sort of an accent.
Where is he?
Well, he wouldn't come in. He went away.
Oh, no, he couldn't have. He couldn't have.
Joe, come back.
Joe rushes into the rain without a coat.
Professor Bear!
She heads up the road. Bear turns and removes his hat.
Where are you going?
Oh, my little friend. I came here to leave your book. My friend published it. He has great hopes. He thinks...
Oh, never mind what he thinks. Did you like it?
It has such truth. Such simple beauty. I cannot tell you what it gives me, my heart.
Oh, but you were going away without telling me. I would never have seen you again. Oh, please come back.
I couldn't intrude. You have guests.
Oh, but they're just my family. My sister's come home. She's married to that boy I told you about.
Herr Laurie?
Yes.
Oh.
And it's the first time we've been together in a long time.
Oh, please, please, Joe. Just one moment before. I have a wish to ask something. Would you... Oh, I have no courage to think that... But if I could hope that... I know. I should not ask. I have nothing to give but my heart, which is so full. And these empty hands.
She takes his hand.
Not empty now.
Or Joe.
Under his umbrella, arms around each other, they head back. The rain stops. As they approach the house, Marmee opens the door for them. Bear lowers his umbrella, removes his hat, and disappears inside after Joe. Over the house, a break in the dark clouds reveal a sky of turquoise blue and a wide arching rainbow. Words appear. The end. Now, in a logo, the golden letters WB are embossed on a shield.